Get Ripple.
Hey, Ripple Podcast. Rosa here. Today's story is going to be a little bit different. I am going to be telling this story solo. Angela's going to be doing one episode a month with me. And the other weeks, I'm going to be having various guests with me listening to the stories. And if that is something that is of interest to you, hit us up on social media and see if the schedule will work and you can be a guest on the Ripple Podcast. We want to get as much input and feedback from people as possible. And if this sounds like something that you would have fun participating in, I'd love to have you as a guest. So today's story, like I said, is going to be a little different. It's just me, all by myself. And if you are a regular listener to the Ripple Podcast, you know that we like to joke around and laugh and make funny jokes and just be kind of sarcastic. That's our personality. And because of this case, it's one I'm not going to be being too silly about. It's a little more serious. For whatever reason, it kind of pulls at my heartstrings. And even though it has been widely covered, it's one that's just intrigued me. And the timeline just happened to be almost 20 years to the day that I started writing this. So without any chatter at the beginning like we normally do, I'm going to go ahead and get started with the story. So on Monday, February 9th, 2004, a 21-year-old nursing student completing her junior year at the University of Massachusetts Amherst named Maura Murray. She submitted a nursing assignment and emailed her professors that she was going to have to leave for a while and wouldn't be on campus for the remainder of the week. She explained that she had to return home due to a death in the family. She packed up her bag with everything that she'd need for her trip. She had clothes, personal items, makeup, schoolwork. And as she was heading off campus, she went to an ATM and took out $280 from the bank account, leaving just about $20 in her account. So she pretty much wiped her account clean. She went to a liquor store from the ATM, and she bought about $40 worth of alcohol. Around 7:30 that evening, in New Hampshire on Route 112, Maura, the girl who was the nursing student, would crash her car when taking a horseshoe bend near this big old red barn. She was driving a 1996 black Saturn, and she hit a tree. Both of her airbags deployed, and the car suffered some front end damage. There were a couple of good Samaritans who would offer assistance to her. You know, they're driving by, seeing this young girl alone in the snow. And she told one of them that she had called AAA and that they were on their way. But both of these good Samaritans would also call the police to report the crash. The police would be on the scene not too much longer later, but they would not find Maura that evening. They'd also not find Maura ever. She hasn't been seen since February 9th, 2004. Here's some backstory on Maura Murray. She was born on May 4th, 1982 in Hanson, Massachusetts. It's a super cute little town that was incorporated in 1820. Its economy was mainly based on lumbering, shingle making, and the cranberry industry. In 1912, a huge cranberry packing house was built that we would all come to know and love as the Ocean Spray Corporation. I have a fascination with Zillow, so I looked up this cute little town and found that you can buy a two-bedroom, two-bath home on 1.74 acres for around $670,000. So compared to California prices, really good deal. Maura had three older siblings, a brother named Fred, and two sisters, Kathleen and Julie, and a younger half-brother named Kurt. Her parents are named Frederick who would go by Fred and Lori. They divorced when Maura was 6 years old. Maura always got great grades throughout her educational career. School and just education as a whole came really easy to her. She would even get phone calls from her older sister when she was attending at West Point and Maura was still in high school, just to help out with homework questions or just explaining things in a way that her sister Julie could understand. Maura was also an amazing track star in high school. She just loved running and excelled at it. Even at a young age, she'd go running with her dad, who had completed multiple full marathons. She won small track meets at her school, and there was this one that was known as the Turkey Trot in her town, and she won it that year and got to take home a turkey as a prize. She was accepted to West Point, New York, where she would study as a chemical engineering student. And that was also the same school that her sister was attending. Her sister Julie absolutely loved West Point, and she just assumed that Maura would love it too. So she kind of encouraged Maura to apply and got accepted to West Point. And they were super happy that they were going to be going to the same school together because they were such great friends. So even though there's, you know, school came really easy for Maura and athletics were really easy for her, there were things that she did struggle with, and some of those were little secrets that she didn't want anyone to know about. And one of those things was an eating disorder, which when she started going to West Point seemed to get worse. Now, I can't speak for Maura, but as someone who has battled an eating disorder from a pretty young age, it's almost a sense of control when you feel that you have no control. It's something that you have power over and that you're making the call on when you feel just powerless. So this is something that started to get worse while Maura was attending West Point, and maybe it was because it was a military type feeling where she, you know, was told where to go, when to go, how to go, and this is something that she felt that she could control. This is just an assumption. Obviously, I don't know that for a fact, but that's just what I'm kind of guessing. She was trying to get a hold on this. There was a book found that talked about, you know, eating disorders and how to overcome them. So she did know that this was an issue and she was trying to take control of it. But it was just something obviously that she didn't talk about, and she may have felt that it was just a secret that she was maybe too scared to ask for help for. Another thing that happened where it may have been a cry for help or just a sense of control was she was actually out with one of her friends during West Point, and they went to a store that was on base, and Maura got caught shoplifting something super teeny tiny, like a thing of mascara or nail polish, probably under $5. And when it happened, her friend had no idea that Maura had done this, and she didn't notice it, and a couple people came up to Maura and said, you know, you need to come with us. And the friend that she was with just was kind of freaking out because she didn't know what was going on. Even though it was something super teeny tiny, when you're at a place like West Point, it doesn't matter how small or large it is. You know, you broke the rules and you need to be punished for those rules. So this was a really hard time for Maura. She actually decided to leave West Point right at this time, and she transferred to the University of Massachusetts Amherst to study nursing. At this time, Maura was driving a car that her dad had owned and was registered to him. He had actually given it to Maura for a while, and this is just a couple of weeks before the crash, and her car that she was driving had started making these like really, really bad noises and was blowing out black smoke. And it turned out that a cylinder had blown a gasket. So instead of a four-cylinder car, she was now driving a three-cylinder car. And just a few days before, Maura and her dad had planned on car shopping because, you know, they both knew that this car that she was driving was on its last leg and it was going to cost more to fix it than it was worth. And he was going to help her find a new car and, you know, find one pretty fast because she needed it for school and for work. And he also knew that the one that she was driving wasn't safe to drive. And he kind of made a big deal about this. He told her, you know, whatever you do, don't drive this car. Get a ride from friends, you know, borrow a car. And she used his car one night to get into town to go do her nursing practicals. And actually, it was like the day before Maura went missing. She had been driving her dad's new car because the next day they were going to go out and go car shopping. So he was in town and let her drive his car. And she ended up crashing his new car into a guardrail at 3:30 a.m. on February 8th. She had been at like a little get-together the evening before and was returning the car to her dad's hotel. So because of the crash, they didn't end up going car shopping. Her dad had to deal with the police and car insurance, and Maura was just so distraught over this. She felt terrible about crashing her dad's car and him having to deal with all of this extra paperwork. And he was just happy that Maura was safe and told her that, you know, she was lucky that she didn't get a DUI. But she swore up and down that she had stopped drinking way before she drove. And when the police showed up to the accident, they had said that she had just slipped on some debris and she didn't show any sign of intoxication. But Maura was just still super, super upset and felt terrible about this. So I'm telling all of this part because for her to be driving the night that she got into a car crash and went missing, for her to be driving that terrible, you know, smoking Saturn on three cylinders out of state, it's just one of the many questions that are going to come up about this strange case. So like I said, Maura was distraught over the crash, and Fred couldn't seem to get her out of this like super guilty, sad feeling. She was just sobbing when he dropped her off at the dorm, and she had said that she was going to call the next day to help finish with the accident forms, but that call never came. So once Fred had heard of the Saturn crash from one of his other daughters, he called the police to find out the details and to see what they were doing to help find Maura. And, you know, it's New England, it's freezing cold, the snow is like 2 feet high, and the police just kind of brushed this guy off, saying that, you know, that when they found the car crash, there were some open alcohol bottles in the car, and she probably just took off with a friend to avoid a DUI charge. You know, she's over 18 and she'll be home soon. This, you know, happens all the time type thing. Don't worry about it. But being the good dad that Fred is, he was absolutely worried about it. So he leaves his house on February 11th to head to New Hampshire to look for Maura himself. Three of Maura's siblings had started to head that way too to look for, you know, Maura and see what was going on. Maura's mom had recently broken her ankle, so everyone kind of decided that she would just stay at the house in case Maura maybe showed up there and the mom would be able to call and tell everybody that she was home. Maura's sister Julie had just received orders to deploy to Iraq, but somehow, luckily, was able to come and help as well. Maura had this longtime boyfriend named Bill, and he was also stationed in the military, but he was able to get leave and come help search too. So Fred, the dad, was the first one to arrive. It had now been maybe 24 hours since Maura had been missing at this point. The police still hadn't been out looking for her yet. Fred drove the same route Maura had taken that evening, looking for any sign of her or clue of what could have happened. and he sees the spot where she'd crashed. There's still snow on the ground, but he could definitely see where the tire tracks had swerved. Later that day, Fred makes his way to the police station to see why no one is searching. I guess they're still thinking that, like, she's hiding from the DUI and is going to show up. The police finally head out to search a little bit, too, and take some dogs with them. But Fred is told to stay at the station. When the officers and the dogs come back, they say that the dogs followed her scent for about 100 yards, but then stopped. So either the dogs weren't really tracking Maura, or according to the officers, quote, the conditions were not ideal for tracking. Okay, so this is a little bit of an update. I listened to Maura's sister's Julie's podcast all about her sister's missing case, trying to get most of my information from her and condensing it into this little quick, you know, hour podcast. For all the real details from, like, the horse's mouth, as they say, go listen to that. I'll link it at the show notes here. But this is one of the updates that Maura's sister Julie said that I thought was interesting. And she says that the item that they chose to have the dogs track off of wasn't a good choice. So in Maura's car, they found a pair of leather gloves that were a Christmas gift. And Christmas wasn't even 2 months earlier. And it really hadn't been that cold yet. So no one even knows if Maura had worn these gloves. So there's a good chance Maura's scent wasn't even really on them. But the police hadn't asked Fred for a better item. And he had been at the station the whole time. He could have said, like, oh, here is a sweatshirt that she went running in that definitely has her scent on it. Or something of, you know, had been worn a few more times. The police also said that the car was locked, and they had to get a search warrant to get inside of it. So that's kind of weird, too, because Fred knew that there was a hide a key on there, and he would know how to get into the car. So just keep that in mind. So the footprints that were in the snow were all deemed, quote, not Maura's. So she couldn't have walked anywhere without leaving a trail. So where did she go, and how did she get there? The family felt like the police weren't helping, and if anything, they were brushing them off and just getting defensive when asked questions. The police kept telling the family that she'll be back when she's ready, but the family, you know, is getting more and more worried that, you know, their loved one is missing and something bad happened. They know Maura better than the police, and they know that she wouldn't just disappear with no word. So that's when Bill, the boyfriend, tells them about a voicemail that he had received. He was going through security at the airport trying to get to Maura when he receives this call from a number that he didn't know. His phone wasn't accessible, and when it started ringing, so it went to voicemail. And on the voicemail, it's just breathing and like a whimpering sound. There's no words. There's no way to know who is on the other end. Fred and Julie, the mom and sister, they both listen, but neither can really identify the sounds that he's hearing. And the police listen, but again, just brush it off. So the update on that is that much later, this call was traced to a Red Cross calling card. And apparently it has no relationship to the case. It was almost like a butt dial type thing. By this point, the police have decided that they know what happened. They had gone to Maura's dorm and saw that she had packed up a bunch of her belongings as if she were going somewhere. There were boxes of items all over the place, just stacked up, packed up. And on top of one of these boxes was a printed out email that Bill, the boyfriend, had written, apologizing for cheating on her. They think that Maura had been battling depression and suicidal thoughts and had bought a bunch of alcohol, went driving, crashed, got out of her car, walked into the snowy woods, and just laid down to die because she was just so depressed. So, talking to the family members about this and not just making random assumptions, the note that was printed out was actually from 2 years before. And it wasn't just sitting out on top of the boxes. It was actually inside of one of them, along with a whole bunch of other letters that Maura was just holding on to. And she wasn't just packing up her dorm room. She'd just been living out of those boxes and never really unpacked since she had just moved in 12 days ago. And Bill and Maura had worked through this whole cheating thing and were on a better path. She had forgiven him. And it was just, you know, an email that she had printed and held onto. So, okay, say that the police were right. And Maura walks into the snow and just lays down, decides to freeze. Well, where is she? And why can't they find her? So now it's day two of the search. And the family starts printing out flyers and they're searching. On day three, the police hold a press conference and they tell the public what they know, including that Maura may be suicidal. Fred is getting more and more frustrated and more worried. He goes out to the area where Maura had crashed and he decides to knock on some doors to see if he can gather some more information himself since the police won't share very much. And the first person that he speaks with is a lady who was the first Good Samaritan that called 911. Her name is Faith, and she invites Fred into her home and actually shows him where she was standing when she looked out the window to see the accident. She'd been in her house and just heard this loud, like, crash, thump sound. And she could see that there was a car, and she retells the story of how she saw the car facing the wrong direction. And she couldn't see if anyone had been hurt, but she could see a man standing outside the car smoking a cigarette. So now we have a man with a cigarette, and we have Faith watching this happening while she's calling 911. But right then, her neighbor, Butch Atwood, pulls up next to the car. And Butch's car blocks her view of the wrecked car. About 6 or 7 minutes later, the police pull up. And that's when Faith stopped watching and walked away from the window. So she'd watched for about 6, 7 minutes, sees a car crashed facing the wrong direction, sees a man smoking a cigarette, sees another car that she knows pull up and block the rest of her view. So she didn't really see too much there. Okay, so something else. Maura didn't smoke. She wasn't a smoker. She was also known to wear her hair up all of the time. Like, her sister said that she never saw her with her hair down. So what I'm thinking, being the detective that I am, is that maybe Faith saw this person with her hair up, maybe looked like a man, and, you know, she's got a big heavy coat on, short hair, and maybe sees, like, the steam coming from her breath into the cold air. So maybe it looked like there was a man smoking. Okay, back to Butch Atwood. He was that guy that pulled up next to the crash. Fred goes and talks with him. And he had been driving a school bus after dropping off students that had gone skiing. And he pulled up alongside the car and he sees a woman with shoulder-length brown hair. He said that she was shaking, either from the cold or from the wreck. And he said she wasn't hurt, that he could see, and he offered to make a call for her and to give her a ride to his place where she could get out of the cold. But she told him that she had already called AAA. Butch said he knew that she was lying because he did, in fact, live close by and knew that the road that she was on was actually a cell phone dead zone. So there was no service and no way she could have made a cell phone call. So Butch leaves her there, drives to his house, and calls the police. The report from that call reads, quote, "One female, no personal injury, shook up, no idea where the female is." So why was this on the report if Butch had talked with her? Why is there the statement, "no idea where the female is"? So Another thing that I found interesting was that Maura apparently didn't even have her phone in the car. She had left it at the dorm room from the party the night before. So just another way of proving that there's no way she could have called AAA. She didn't even have a phone on her, let alone was in a place where she could call. So when Fred knocks on Butch's door, he shows Butch a picture of Maura and asks if he had seen this woman, and Butch says no. So Butch's story keeps changing. Sometimes he says that he saw Maura in the car seat, and sometimes, you know, she's sitting behind the airbag struggling to get out. Other times he says that he saw her standing outside the car. Sometimes he's out of the car, sometimes he's in it. For whatever reason, he doesn't have a story that he is going to stick with. He keeps flipping and flopping around and keeps giving different answers. So even if Fred didn't get much helpful information from Butch, and the little amount that he did get from Faith is kind of fuzzy, it was still more than the police had gathered because they hadn't come to interview either person. The only thing that had been asked of Faith was on the night of the crash. One of the officers had come to her and said, "Where's the girl?" That's it, nothing else. Faith hadn't even mentioned she had seen a girl. She thought what she saw was a man smoking a cigarette. So Fred drives over to a Vermont police station to hang up missing posters. No one at that station had heard of Maura. The same thing happened at the next station. These police were not spreading the word, images, nothing of Maura, other than to be on the lookout for this woman. But there was no urgency. There was no real reason because they were still sticking to the story of she would probably show up soon. The police go to Maura's dorm again to talk with some of the other students that she had gone to school with and collect a few items from her dorm room, including her computer. When her computer is looked over, they find directions to Vermont and New Hampshire. And she'd even looked up places to stay in those areas, but they couldn't get a confirmation of anywhere that she had booked. One of the people that they did talk to at the school was a woman named Karen May. She had worked with Maura, and she had said that a couple of days before Maura went missing, on February 5th, 2004, Maura had been working her security guard checking school IDs. She said that around 1 a.m., she got a call from someone saying that Maura was super upset, to the point of just being unresponsive and out of it, crying and repeating the words over and over, "My sister, my sister." So Karen went to go see what was going on, and she got Maura and walked her back to her room and asked her if she wanted some company. Did she want her to stay with her? Because she just felt bad leaving her all by herself, being that upset. And Maura assured her that her roommate would be with her and that she would be okay. But that was another lie because Maura had just moved in 12 days earlier and she'd moved into a single. She didn't have a roommate at all. The reason that Maura was so upset is because that night that she had been working her security shift, around 10 p.m., she got a call from her older sister, Kathleen. And her sister had been in a rehab facility for alcohol, and her fiance had just picked her up because she was leaving the facility. But he picks her up, and the first stop they make is a liquor store. So this asshole is like obviously not supportive of her sober journey. Maura just felt helpless, like, you know, her sister's trying to make good choices and this guy, you know, the first place they go is a liquor store. So she's just super upset and sad that she can't help her sister. That's totally understandable, but she continued to work her shift for 3 more hours before going into this breakdown. So had she been sitting there that whole time just playing different scenes through her head until she couldn't deal with it anymore? What was happening in her mind that made her just all of a sudden at 1 a.m. get so distraught? She had talked to her boyfriend, Bill, that evening as well, and he said that she was fine on the call that they had. So no one really knew what had happened on this call until October of 2017, when Kathleen tells her side of the story. But again, why did it take so many hours for this to hit Maura and cause such a delayed breakdown? Julie thinks it's because Maura was such a perfectionist. She didn't want anyone to see any mistakes she made, any weakness she had. She was always the best at everything, you know, in track, got the best grades. So once, you know, shit started hitting the fan, it might have just piled on until she couldn't deal with anymore. You know, her eating disorder, she'd gotten actually in trouble with binge eating. She had a friend's credit card that she had gotten a hold of, and she had been ordering food to be sent to her dorm room without the friend's knowledge. And campus security set up like a little sting operation and caught her. And, you know, Maura didn't try to deny what she was doing. She fully admitted to it, and the school had put her on probation. So it was kind of seems like a lot all at once that was just, you know, maybe she couldn't handle anymore. The eating disorder, being caught, the stealing over at West Point, now her sister, and just feeling helpless. Did she just need to get out of there for a while because she just had no control and just felt helpless? These different issues, both internally and externally, that Maura was battling is what the police believed, that she just needed a way out, whether it was just to get away for a little while or forever. Okay, so back to the missing days. It's now Thursday, and Bill and Fred, they go to the garage where the police have stored Maura's car. Everything that was in the car at the time of the crash is now out of it and laid all over the ground. And they're surprised at what they see because they were under the assumption that her car was just totaled. And what they see, though, in front of them is, you know, some front end damage to the driver's side. And the windshield has a large crack and both airbags had deployed. But the bumper and the engine didn't seem to be moved at all. I rear-ended the back of a FedEx truck one point, and my little car pretty much went under it up to a point. So just the hood kind of squished up like an accordion, but the engine and the rest of my car was actually okay. So I kind of understand where that's coming from, but I could probably drive my car for a little bit longer. This accident with Maura, the upper radiator support was bent, but that was it. There was no foreign material embedded in the car from like maybe a tree or a telephone pole, an animal. There wasn't even any paint chipped. So what did she hit? How did she hit it? Was it like a snowbank? Or, like some people may believe, was this staged ahead of time to make it look like an accident so Maura could get out of there? Bill and Fred, they see 109 items around the car. There's snacks, there's school books, there's her medication, there's maps, note cards with handwritten directions to Vermont, a bunch of clothes that she had packed, the alcohol that she had bought that day. There was some random broken car part from a Chrysler that they still don't know where that's from. But the books that she had in her car, they were her school textbooks. So if you're planning to either commit suicide or disappear forever, why would you take your school books with you? Like, if you weren't planning on returning to school, why would you need those? Also in her car was the paperwork that she was going to go over with her dad for insurance, and a form to get her New Hampshire license reinstated. So these two forms were things that she had to look up and get. They weren't like already in her car that she'd been driving around with for weeks. She had to look them up, print them out, go and get them. So why would she take that time to collect them if she wasn't going to use them? If she wasn't going to give that paperwork to her dad to help with the insurance. If she wasn't going to go and submit the form to get her license reinstated, why would she have this? There was also a bunch of red splatter on the ceiling and the driver's side of the door, but that was assumed to be wine from an earlier party that she had been to the night before. Fred decides he wants to see if the car will start, and like I said before, he knows where the spare key is, so he goes and gets it from the wheel well, and the car fires up with no hesitation. So this just kind of adds another little bit of question to the story, like, why didn't she keep driving? If the car was still running, yes, it wasn't running well probably, but it hadn't been for quite a while. Why didn't she just keep going? There was also the rag in the tailpipe, which a lot of people, if you go on Reddit or whatever, will talk about this whole rag in the tailpipe thing. But her dad actually talks about that, and this was advice given to her by her dad to help hide the smoke that her car was making to avoid from getting pulled over. And it was mainly just stick a rag in the tailpipe if you see a policeman that you think you might get pulled over. You know, you're not going to drive around for miles and miles and miles with a rag in your tailpipe. It's just to avoid that one little stretch of road where a police is kind of watching, and you know, she didn't want to get pulled over because of all of the black smoke the car was making. So on Sunday, February 15th, the official accident report was finally completed. It's 10 days after Maura had been missing. There was another ground search that had happened by the fish and game, and they took cadaver dogs with them, but still nothing was found. All the evidence was given back to the family, and the family kind of felt like this was a nonverbal way of telling them that they were done with the case. Like, we're done searching. Here's all the evidence we had. But the family and a handful of volunteers kept searching day after day. The family eventually had to go back home. They had to go back to work, go back to their life. But for the next year, Fred went back to search every single weekend, and he would still go to the police and ask for help, for information, for anything, but he got nothing. He even heard that the police were threatening to arrest people that were trying to help. One of those people that the police threatened to arrest was a man named John Smith. John Smith was a former law agent and had heard of Maura's story and the family's search for her, and he was able to get a hold of the Murrays and call them saying he wanted to help. And the New Hampshire police actually went to his work and said that, you know, asked him, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And he tells them that he just feels for the family and wanted to see if there was anything that he could do to help, since he knows some of, like, how the law works. And the two officers that went to talk to him told him to stop offering his help and to stay out of it, or he'd be arrested for interfering with an investigation. And John's like, dude, I'm not, you know, I don't want to get arrested for this. So he kind of backed off for a little while. And when Fred found out about this, he, you know, tracked him down somehow and found him in a grocery store parking lot. And he talked to him about, like, the help that he had offered. And John told him, you know, listen, I really did want to help you, but I just can't now. I can't, you know, risk being arrested for strangers. Fred said, you know, that he understood, he didn't want anyone else to get in any trouble, and he left. And John says that as Fred was driving away, he just broke down in the parking lot, you know, just heartbroken for this father looking for his missing daughter. So a couple weeks later, John just can't, you know, shake this feeling, and he's like, screw it, and he starts to help the family. And he's actually been helping ever since, for almost 20 years. So one of the theories that people on Reddit talk about is that Maura was involved in a hit and run the day before and staged everything else to avoid getting in trouble. Okay, maybe I could see that. But I can't see her putting her family through this for 20 years, no matter how much trouble she would have been in. It just from, you know, the interviews I listened to and read, that her family just seemed so caring and loving of each other that, you know, they would have maybe been upset with Maura for a little bit, but they would have supported her and helped her get through this. I can't see Maura just disappearing and leaving her family all to wonder about her for this long. There was also never a report of a hit and run, and no one saw her car with any damage before the accident. And also, she was working her shift that night in the security area, and no one saw her leave and then come back. So I feel like that theory is kind of debunked. Another rumor is the dorm party that she had gone to in her dad's car when she crashed on the debris that night. And she was there with her friend named Kate at this party, quote unquote party. But Kate says that it was just a few people, like, you know, probably less than 10 because it's in a dorm room and dorm rooms are teeny tiny. And Kate says that Maura seemed tired and mentioned more than once that she wanted to get her dad's car back to him. So around 2:30 that morning, she says she's leaving to go back to her dorm. But she crashed her dad's car at 3:30, so like an hour later, and it was just a mile away from the dorms. So where did she go in that hour, and what happened for real? You know, she's tired. I want to go home. I want to get my dad's car back to him. She finally leaves. And then an hour later, that crash happens. Again, a little bit more about that party. It was at this girl named Sarah's house, and Kate drove there with Maura. And Bill, the boyfriend, said he had met and hung out with Kate once, but didn't really know Sarah at all. When Bill and Maura were playing phone tag, like trying to talk with each other the day before she went missing, he was also calling Sarah and Kate multiple times to try to track down Maura. But if you ask Bill about this, he says he doesn't remember calling them or what it would have been about. So his story kind of fluctuates back and forth as well. I don't know these people, but I'm going to be calling them over and over again to look for my girlfriend. And the last email that Maura sent to him was the day that she went missing at 1 p.m. And it says, quote, "I got your messages, but honestly, I don't feel like talking to much of anyone. I promise to call you today, though. Love you, Maura." Some people think that Bill is involved in Maura going missing, but he wasn't in the same state when she went missing. And his story kind of is a little weird about who he talked to, when he talked to them. But if he had anything to do with this, he would have had to have hired somebody, and he's never been a suspect in the police's eyes. So I kind of think that that's just a reach when you think that Bill was involved. So then there's this other woman named Karen, and she's driving and she passes by Maura on the side of the road. She sees her facing west in the eastbound lane, so totally 180 there. Karen says that it's nose to nose with a police SUV. And she knows this because she had seen that same police SUV two times while driving, and she noted the number 001 on it, which is driven by Chief Williams. She sees the missing Maura case on TV and calls the police station to tell them what she saw that night. And they call her back and they start questioning her, and they're trying to make her doubt herself, she feels. And she's like, "No, I'm sticking to my story. You're not going to convince me otherwise. I know what I saw. I saw the number 001. I saw the direction of the car. I saw the police SUV facing the car." But here's the thing. Chief Williams, the driver of 001, wasn't on duty that night, but the morning after the accident, he requested a full roster of who was working and who responded to the crash. So now enters Sergeant Cecil Smith, and he comes forward and says that he was actually driving Chief Williams's vehicle that night, and there was nothing, you know, unusual about it. However, a driver was stopped earlier that evening by Sergeant Cecil Smith, and he wasn't driving 001 police SUV. He was driving a police sedan. So to confirm who's telling the truth here, either the man that got the ticket that evening or Chief Williams and Sergeant Cecil's story, the police logs could easily be checked, right? You go back, you go, okay, this man, Dan, got a ticket this evening. Sergeant Cecil gave him the ticket and he was in police cruiser, blah, 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 right? Easy. But this traffic ticket call isn't on any of the logs. They can't find the information anywhere. But the local paper has the story about it. And the exact time Dan is getting his ticket, the 001 SUV was actually being pulled out of a snowbank. So how could that SUV be driven by Sergeant Cecil if it was in fact being pulled out of a snowbank at that time? So there's another person that got a ticket by Cecil Smith that night right before Morris crash, but they have refused to speak to anyone for these 20 years. So they can't get a confirmation of who was driving what that evening. A little confusing about, you know, all these new players and cars and stuff happening in the story. Like I said, if you want all of the information, go to Morris Sisters podcast and listen to her story. But I found that very, very interesting. So apparently the SUV was in the snowbank ditch because Chief Williams had been driving under the influence. He later quits the police department because he's arrested for drunk driving, and he's arrested by Sergeant Cecil Smith, ironically. So some people speculate that Sergeant Smith came and switched vehicles with Chief Williams for a bit. Maybe Chief Williams took him home to sober up in one car and then drove back to the station, dropped off the vehicle, and had someone drive him back to the SUV. Maybe the SUV was towed back to the police station and he decided to drive it later that evening. But the first be on the lookout call to go out was from Cecil Smith. And he describes Mora as being 5'7 with brown hair, but he claims to have never seen her. And then on the second call, they have her name and say she's 5'5 and 120 pounds with black hair past her shoulders. So different descriptions, but it's hard to be on the lookout for someone that you've never seen. So where did he get his information about Mora? How did he know how tall she was, how much she weighed, what color hair she had? So that's all a big question mark there too. So what did happen? Was it really an accident? Did Mora plan this elaborate escape from her life? Where did she go? Who did she go with? What happened to Mora? One other thing that was found in the car was a handwritten note with a phone number on it. Police never looked into this phone number or who owned this phone, but Julie, Mora's sister, did. And 19 years later, found out that they owned a condo not too far from the direction that Mora was headed. So was Mora going to this condo? Was she going to stay there for a while? Things that were never recovered from the car were Mora's wallet, her ID, her keys, and some of the alcohol that she had purchased that evening. Okay, so I know I just threw 800 different facts at you and different theories and speculations as to what happened to Mora. And I know I did this in a totally different format and style than you're used to. And while you were listening, you probably thought of a whole bunch of questions that maybe I knew the answer to, or maybe I had no clue as to how to answer. But if that is something that you think would be kind of fun to participate in, I would love to have you as a guest on an upcoming episode. give us a message on any of our socials or shoot us an email. Again, I will put that on our show notes. And I just want to thank you again for listening. I know this was super different and more serious and not as silly and crazy as we normally get, but for whatever reason, the story really pulled at my little heartstrings. But thanks again for listening, and don't forget to be a fountain and not a drain. Bye.